Connecticut Today for Tuesday, May 19th, as we follow, again, the coronavirus situation. We spoke to an area college professor on how organized crime, believe it or not, is dealing with the coronavirus. Here's a hint, they're ramping up computer fraud. State Rep. Gail Laviel, 143rd District, Fairfield County Republican, joined us to talk about a couple of issues. The lack of interaction between Governor Ned Lamont and the General Assembly regarding coronavirus regulations and the dissolving of the Dalio Educational Partnership. And we also carry Governor Ned Lamont's daily coronavirus briefing with a couple of high-profile doctors on hand. We hear about the restaurant business and COVID-19 and the hair salon business and the retail business. And, you know, maybe small business owners that are your neighbors, friends and neighbors that are affected by this, mostly negatively. Some people positively, as their, you know, spotlight is on what they do for a living, playing a greater role in all this. But there are some areas that we don't hear about that are being affected by COVID-19 that may not be front of mind. Among those, sports betting, gambling, and, yes, organized crime. Our next guest is an associate professor of investigations at the Henry C. Lee College of Criminal Justice at the University of New Haven. Dr. Declan Hill joins us on the phone to talk about that. Dr. Hill, Paul at WICC, how are you today?
Paul, I got to say, like everyone else in Connecticut, I'm incredibly impressed with your use of Latin. You know, bacterium. I was standing up. I was, you know, like my high school Latin classes that I've forgotten decades ago. I'm like, man, this man knows his stuff. So whatever I tell about organized crime and sports gambling in the next few minutes pales to your correct Latin usage. Well done, brother. Well done.
Well, all I'm doing, Dr. Hill, is just putting a UM on the, you know, I've got coffeeum in front of me and ballpoint pennium, whatever. So listen, when I saw your expertise here, I said this is the guy I have to ask. So are we to feel sorry for the, well, people call them bookies. I know people don't like that. Somebody said don't call them bookies, call them paramutual consultants. So maybe we'll do that. are they in trouble with this thing or not? Tell me a little about that.
Yeah, they are cratering, and we'll get to organized crime in a second, because what's going on in organized crime is really, really interesting now. Sports gambling around the world has cratered because, you know, there's nothing to gamble on. I mean, there's literally no NFL, no NBA, no MLB, like nothing. And that goes around the world. You know, there's no English Premier League. There's, you know, the Bundesliga, that German soccer league is just maybe beginning to open up in the last few days in front of empty stadiums. In South Korea, they're so desperate, they're putting sex dolls in the stadiums to watch because they can't, you know, they can't actually have soccer in front of.
I saw that. That was hysterical. I saw that.
I can't say anything. I'm not touching that thing. Yeah. It's just too weird for me. But look, sports gambling is cratered and the market has become so desperate that they're gambling on stuff like Tajikistan basketball, you know, Rwandan soccer, Russian table tennis. They're just so desperate to service this market, which has just cratered. It's in really bad state.
And you know, Dr. Hill, a lot of people don't realize, and we've had the debates here in Connecticut as to whether we should do it. And, you know, they see the success of DraftKings and FanDuel and New Jersey and Pennsylvania and all this. But, you know, I try to tell people, some of whom are, you know, quite surprised when I say, you know, sports gambling is not a big deal in other parts of the world. It's kind of like the lottery. It's been there forever, and I can imagine how some of these countries, parts of the UK, other areas of the world, are just seeing a tremendous drop-off in revenue here.
It's a huge amount. You know, we're going to be wading into the pool of malarkey as soon as you start talking about tax revenue from sports gambling. Because every bookie, and I think that's the correct term, every bookie is appealing to state legislatures around and across America since May 14th to 2018 when the U.S. Supreme Court basically legalized sports gambling in the states. And they kicked it over to the states and said, hey, whatever you want to do in Connecticut and New Jersey and New York. And so since then, the state legislatures have been invaded by this army of lobbyists who say two things. One, they say, oh, sports gambling is going to solve every problem, every pothole, every kid short of opportunity is going to be helped by sports gambling. But in the same time, they say, don't tax us. So you have this ocean of malarkey that is just flowing across state capitals, across our country. So the key thing at this moment, however, is COVID-19 has blasted that industry. There's only one exception, and that is esports. So yeah. For all our listeners under the age of 25, they're not going to be surprised by this, but anyone over 25, esports has just expanded exponentially, both in general because of the demographics and also because you can do it. You know, so there are major esports events and campaigns that are going on. And that's really bad news, not for sports gambling, because sports gambling is taking on an enormous amount of cash gambling on esports.
Yeah.
I was speaking to an offshore bookie, and he was saying, and I want to be very careful about this so that our listeners know what he was saying.
Okay.
Year over year, esports brings them as much money as the National Football League.
Oh, come on. That's shocking. That, to me, is shocking.
That is an extraordinary thing. Now, I want to just say it's year over year. And as you know, the National Football League only goes essentially from September to Super Bowl.
Yeah.
And on those weeks, it totally dominates. It just things. But esports, when you add in all the other weeks when National Football League is not moving, nothing's going on, that brings it up. So, over 12 months, esports now in these offshore bookmaking operations is equal to the National Football League. The second thing, which is a disaster for regular sports, is that millions, tens of millions of fans are now watching esports. And they're shifting their loyalty, they're shifting their allegiance, particularly if they're younger demographic. Because these traditional sports like the NFL, like the NBA, like soccer, have kind of got the reputation of dad's sports. They're what dad watches. I'm 19, 20, whatever. I want to do something. And That's the job of young people, is to be rebellious and question and really think about what is good and what is bad.
Mm-hmm.
And they're turning away. And this COVID-19 cratering of sports and sports gambling on regular sports, where only esports is going on now, has been a real disaster for major sports leagues.
Interesting stuff. Dr. Declan Hill is the guest. Dr. Hill, hang on. We're going to take a break, come back and talk more about this, the impact on the sports betting industry, gambling facilities, and organized crime as well. All from this, virus that we can't see, this pathogen that is hitting every part of our lives. Straight ahead, more with Dr. Declan Hill after this on Connecticut Today. And we continue with Dr. Declan Hill from the University of New Haven. By the way, we should mention his book, you should read it, The Fix, Organized Crime and Soccer, has appeared in 21 languages. Pretty impressive. Dr. Hill, what are all those guys that were fixing soccer games doing now with COVID-19?
There's a great quote, as you know from reading my stuff. I do a lot of undercover stuff, a lot of infiltration of gangs, and there was a law enforcement in Italy that was recently covertly taping a couple of mobsters. They weren't Sicilian mafia. They were another of those organized crime groups over there. We're actually now bigger than the mob.
Yeah.
And one guy says, hey, you know, your problem is you're still doing bam bam, but I do click click. I go to the best universities and I get the guys that can go click click, and I make more money than you can ever do.
Wow.
And when he was saying bam, bam, he was pointing his fingers like a gun.
Yeah, sure.
That one quote, Paul, basically sums up where organized crime is in general and very specifically with COVID-19. They're like, hey, man, we're not shooting people anymore. Or, I mean, they do, but much less. It's now we've got to infiltrate the net. We've got to infiltrate this new way of making cash. We're hiring these bright little, you know, kids and hackers, and we're taking over. And since COVID-19, I was tuning into this special seminar among organized crime experts, and one of the guys was saying 600% increase in online crime since mid-March. 600%. You know, so this is just, everyone is now online. This is the opportunity that organized crime is seeing, and this is their new growth field.
Well, and that old notion, Dr. Hill, is that, well, if we just stop, you know, X evil, evil X here, then the criminals are going to go away. Well, no, that's not true, because they'll move on to, you know, what have we seen in years, right? Booze, drugs, prostitution. Now it's cybercrime. A criminal, not maybe all of them, you can rehab a few percent here and there, but criminals are criminals in essence, correct?
Yeah, specifically organized crime. You know, there's the small fry, there's the people that get caught up. But when you're talking about Ndrangheta is the Calabrian mob, Camorra, that's the guys out of Naples and Sorrento and that area, Sacra Corona, you know, the mafia. These guys are, you know, it's bred into these clans. They don't even see the world in the same way as we do. You know, it's just a way of making cash. But that quote, no bam bam, just click click, is the summation of where organized crime is going. So I really caution our listeners, you know, when you're out there, when you're out on the internet, when you're doing this stuff, they're there, they're hunting. They're wolves out there now, and they are focused on the internet, particularly with COVID-19, in ways that haven't been, you know, we haven't seen before.
So in a way, Dr. Hill, then, are you saying that the COVID-19 outbreak, the pandemic we're in, the sort of timeout that we're in, has that served almost like a spring training for these clans where, you know what, they're using this time to really get their feet wet, and this is going to give them a springboard to be stronger maybe in a year or so? Is that what we're looking at?
Yeah, look, you know, I don't know about you guys, but my Visa card, you know, they didn't stop the interest payments when, you know, everything shut down. And it's the same thing in organized crime. If you're part of one of those clans, you're still supposed to be making cash.
Yeah.
And your capo isn't going to go, oh, you know, so sorry, COVID-19, guess everyone, we're just going to sit around and play dominoes. It's like, where's the cash? You're supposed to be earning me money. So go use Uber to deliver drugs if you can't do it yourself. Go do this kind of stuff. Go find ways of making cash. So they have done a paradigm shift, as other industries have had to do. And, you know, there's always been cyber crime since the first internet, but this is really strong, you know, massive increase. It's like cyber crime has just taken a massive dose of steroids.
Are the quote-unquote legitimate gambling organizations here, the DraftKings, the FanDuels, the Indian casinos in various states, the state-run casinos, whatever, do you think they're putting pressure on the pro leagues here, maybe behind the scenes, to come up with something, even if they play, you know, these abbreviated playoffs or abbreviated seasons? Are they turning the screws, you think, Dr. Hill, behind the scene or not?
Look, it's an incestuous pool of interconnected people. I mean, FanDuel and DraftKings are, you know, they're cooperating with each other. There are a number of National Football League owners like Mark Cuban who have shares in them. The NFL has taken, you know, as the league itself has taken percentage in some of these betting companies. The big picture, taking COVID-19 out of the way, is the sports leagues from about 2013, 2014, have got into the gambleization of their product. So they're looking for ways of increasing revenue on sports, and they've decided that just having fans isn't enough. They're going to take a quantum leap up, and they're going to gambleize on their sport. So in the same way, I guess in the past, there were people that would go to horse races and watch it just for the sake of the horses and enjoy the thrill of the horse. But, you know, over the centuries, horse racing has become primary a vehicle for gambling. So too is with our major leagues. And I think that we're going to see the same thing in America that we've seen in Western Europe and Asia. You know, Western Europe liberalized their gambling, sports gambling, about 15, 20 years ago. And particularly the younger demographic is, you know, they cannot consume, if you excuse that verb, but I'm using it deliberately, a sports game without gambling, you know, on multiple different accounts, on their mobile phone, whatever. This is the, you know, this is the way sports is now, quote, consumed. You got to be constantly gambling. And the NFL, the major leagues want a percentage of that action.
So they can't wait until COVID-19 is done or they can start. Fascinating stuff. His book is The Fix, Organized Crime in Soccer. He's been updating us for the past few minutes on what is going on with sports betting, sports gambling, and organized crime during COVID-19. From the Henry C. Lee College of Criminal Justice and Forensic Sciences at the University of New Haven, Dr. Declan Hill. Dr. Hill, thanks so much. It has been fascinating. We'll hook up in the future. Thanks.
I hope so, brother. I was frantically looking at Google Translate, seeing if I could get thank you in Latin. I can't find it.
And my, you know what funny story is? My son actually, and he's long graduated college now. He lives in New York. He actually, don't ask me why or how, doctor, you know, Dr. Hill. He actually took 3 years of Latin voluntarily in prep school. We're still trying to figure that out.
He's a better man than we are.
Yeah, I'll tell him you said that. Dr. Hill, thanks. Done. Declan, be good. We'll talk. Thanks.
Cheers. All the best.
Okay, bye-bye. Gail Laviel. Gail, Paul here. How are you today?
Oh, Paul, how are you? I'm fine.
It's a gorgeous day, at least that. So the day before we begin our rebirth, at least it's sunny and breezy outside.
Our rebirth.
But, Gail, no, honestly, because people just want to have something to hold on to. But I don't blame you folks, you guys and gals in the General Assembly, frankly, of both parties, who, Gail, I don't understand why you're not being consulted a little more on this. Tell me if I'm wrong, though. Are there things going on behind the scenes, or are you folks in the dark as much as we are?
Oh, we're totally in the dark. And it's not just, I mean, I got to tell you, it's not just Republicans. The Democrats have also expressed a great deal of frustration because it seems as though the governor and the executive branch are just going along their merry way without asking anybody anything. And, you know, the most recent example of that was the $2 million contract with Boston Consulting Group to come in and do we don't know what. I mean, that's $2 million that could be spent on the nursing homes, for example.
Yeah, yeah.
And so we don't know what the Boston Consulting Group is doing. The big reopened Connecticut appointed advisory committee is going to shut down after having given one set of recommendations that no one was consulted about. And no, the legislature, I mean, you know, okay, maybe he wants to have the executive decision-making authority, but the legislators are the people who have contact with constituents day after day. And we certainly could have brought some constructive input to the decision-making process.
Do you think, Gail, do you think in any way, was this an effort, and I'm just kind of throwing this out there, I'm not accusing anyone of anything,
no, sure.
Was this an effort to try and avoid what is happening, you see, in some other states without taking sides, where particularly in Michigan and other states where some of the state legislators in those states are saying, well, no, we don't agree with this. Was this an effort, you think, on the governor's part and his support people to say, well, listen, we don't need that right now, so we're just not going to listen to anyone? Is that a case of what's going on here or no?
Well, Paul, I don't know. I mean, I can't speak for the governor, but what I will say is that this tendency to do everything in the dark of night has been just consistent. I mean, you saw what happened today with the Dalio partnership. The Dalios have pulled out because he had promised them total secrecy, you know, no subject to FOI, no nothing, and that didn't work. The hairdressers, you've seen what that fiasco is.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
He didn't ask any hairdressers before he decided that they would open tomorrow. And some of them wanted to and some of them didn't. But he could have at least found that out before he had to cancel everything at the 11th hour. The other thing is the education advisory group. There's not a single active teacher. There's not a single active superintendent or principal. There's not a single parent who's been invited to provide input with the, you know, some legitimacy conferred on them. Nothing. They don't hear anybody. He seems to go about these things all by himself. And, of course, the majority in the legislature who approved some of these things, like the Dalio partnership not being subject to FOI, they're not blameless, but it really does seem to be an overall tendency of this administration, and not just for COVID.
Is that maybe, you think, Gail, a product of electing a governor? And it's not only here, but it happens in all states. Heck, it's happening in Washington now. Of electing someone who feels that he or she does not want to be in the process or can't relate to the people that one has to deal with who were duly elected by the people?
Well, I don't know. I can tell you this, though. That would have been okay if it had happened once, you know? Make a mistake, see that it's not working out, and don't do it again. You could understand that, you know, if you haven't been in government. Okay.
Sure. Yeah.
But he keeps doing it, Paul. He keeps doing it over and over again. And look at Tolls. You know, okay, what I was doing didn't stick. I'm just going to come out with this trucks thing. And it was really kind of a surprise to everybody. And that didn't work either, did it? It just doesn't stop. It's if you're out there in a public position and you come into it not understanding the responsibilities of that public position, okay. But then you get kicked in the teeth once by your own actions.
Mm-hmm.
And then you keep doing the same thing? That, to me, I don't get it. I can't honestly explain it. I just know that it's not working out, and it has a lot of people extremely angry. And what's more, we're in a situation where nobody can control the environment at all. Everybody's very anxious. And I would say that distrust of the state government is at its height, higher than it's ever been.
What are you hearing, Gail, from some of your constituents in the 143rd?
Well, I can tell you that there are parents all over the place. I represent a city, Norwalk, and I also represent two small towns, Westport and Wilton. So they're very different. But the parents in both kinds of places are just outraged that nobody is listening to them about the start of the school year. You know, nobody knows whether schools are going to open or not or partially, and nobody's asking them how it went, how it's going. They're very angry. A lot of the hair salon people down here were, you know, some of them more reluctantly than others were getting ready to open, but they went to a lot of trouble to get ready to open. And they just wish, regardless of what their point of view on it was, that they had known that they weren't going to open earlier than they did.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 2 days, they just felt it was an incredible lack of respect. And the Dalio thing, people are just laughing.
Yeah, you know what? Let's take a break because I want to come back and talk about that, Gail. And Mr. and Mrs. Dalio, for whatever good intentions they have, they seem to be foisting their venom at a couple of high-ranking people of the Republican Party. We'll talk about that straight ahead. State Rep. Gail Laviella is with us. We'll take a break and come back after traffic and weather together here on WICC. State Rep. Gail Laviella, Republican, District 143. A few more minutes with her. And, Gail, I'm glad you brought up the Dalio thing. And a lot of people may be familiar with this. A very rich husband and wife from Fairfield County, Ray and Barbara Dalio, had pledged $100 million to work in concert with the state to help education. Sounds very nice on the surface, but there was a burning controversy for a long time with this, Gail, regarding how this situation would be monitored. And now the Dalios are foisting some darts at Themis Claridis and Vin Candelora here. But, you know, I'm looking at some of the quotes here, Gail, and even some quotes from Democrats here are not exactly rosy about this. Just explain to the listeners here who might not be completely tied into this what the problem was.
Right. Well, it wasn't just that the Dalios were going to give $100 million, which is very nice and very well-intentioned. It was that they went to the governor and asked for a partnership with the state, and he said, oh, sure, we'll match that with $100 million of taxpayers, right? State dollars, $100 million. Now, as soon as you bring in taxpayers, they have a right to know what's being done with their money and how the decisions are being made, right? So, I mean, that's a lot of money. So this was all sprung on the legislature in a last-minute change to a budget bill. Now I'm even forgetting which year it was. I think it was... Was it the year before? It doesn't matter.
Are you saying, Gail, you're saying it's all a blur? Is that
well, it just so many of these things happen all the time.
Yeah.
But anyway, we were you know, having been up all night doing the budget bill and so on. We get the final draft of the bill that we're supposed to debate, and there this thing is buried in it, saying that over 5 years, $100 million of taxpayer dollars would be going into this,
mm-hmm.
and there was no provision for any of the proceedings of the partnership that would be formed between the Dalios and the state to be made public, that the public could not attend the meetings, they would not be televised, that they would be able to make certain decisions behind closed doors, and that what would be happening with all of that money would not be open to public scrutiny. So, of course, that raised a lot of eyebrows. And our leadership in the House was particularly assiduous in trying to make sure that the public got access to it. Nobody was against having the Dalios get money, of course, on the contrary. But not allowing people to know what was done with their money and not allowing parents to have some insight into how their kids would be assisted, was just seemed to be way, way off. And you would think that in order to do a good deed and help people in a disinterested way, you wouldn't mind if people knew what you were doing. So it came as a surprise that when this was brought up, that the Dalios and the governor joined them, insisted on maintaining the secrecy. And then, of course, it was also frustrating that despite this being in the budget bill, all the majority Democrats voted for the bill.
Yeah.
And so they were, of course, even if they later on said, you know, we don't support this, they certainly did initially. The secrecy didn't bother them. So it's really the inclusion of that taxpayer money. And I don't understand.
Yeah, I don't get
why that's so disturbing.
Yeah, and it even says here in the stories I've been reading here, Gail, that the Dalios are going to continue the commitment. They just won't be doing it in partnership with the state. And listen, bless them. It's wonderful. But I mean, if I have that kind of money, okay, and I'm at this rate, I'm probably not going to. But if I ever have that much, that kind of money, I would never. And I don't know what they're thinking is, Gail. I would never be so obstinate as to say, well, it's either going to work this way or we're not going to work with the state. If you truly love the state, right, as they profess to do, then go along with the with the sunlight provisions of this. I don't know, Gail. It doesn't make sense to me.
Well, what it gave the impression of, I mean, it really did, and there's no way to deny this, is that they wanted to be able to make public policy without having been anointed or elected to do that, but instead just because they could pay for it. Here, let me pay some money and I get to make public policy.
Yeah. Which you can still go ahead.
Is that what we do in a representative government?
Yeah, go ahead and do it, but don't, as you say, Gail, don't expect state taxpayer money to be matched to this, you know?
Exactly, and, you know, expect to be... If you want to give all your money to, let's say, Hartford instead of giving it to Bridgeport, that's your business. But if you've got taxpayer money, it's not your business.
And Gail Aviel, Gail, I'm sorry, I've got to run. I'm up against the time-wise. But thank you for commenting today on both this and the COVID-19 situation. Gail Aviel, Republican State Rep, District 143, the wonders of the General Assembly. Gail, just when you think it's all been written, a new chapter is pen to paper, I'm telling you. Gail, thanks.
Paul.
We appreciate the time. Thanks, Gail Aviel.
Appreciate being here. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Appreciate it, Gail.
But first, let me give you the daily summary. It is... I think good news, given where we thought we should be on the day before May 20th, which is our phase one reopening day. Positive cases as a percentage of tests performed is less than 5%. That's the lowest we've seen, I think, in a couple of months. And also, it's very good news. You see, the number of tests performed is 7,800. So we've gone through that 42,000 number we were counting on. Now north of 50,000 is based upon these metrics. Number of hospitalized continues to go down slowly, but fortunately, the number of fatalities. So these are trend lines that I think give us some confidence that what we're trying to do tomorrow with our slow and methodical reopening, the timing is right. We've hit the key metrics that we thought we would. I just want you to know that we have a lot of expertise inside of this building. I think you know from the reopening advisory board, we have amazing expertise around the state. We got folks from the scientific community, we got from the folks from the business community. They'll be giving their report tomorrow. But we've also had a couple of advisors who have informally helped us along the way, who bring an awful lot of breadth of perspective to what we're trying to do. And they are, Dr. Scott Gottlieb and Zeke Emanuel. Scott's gonna say a few things first. I always like to boast about people's Connecticut roots. Scott is a Wesleyan guy, Pfizer board. And to me, I got him because he's a dad in Westport. And I think I gave him a call probably, Scott, on the day that we announced that schools had to close down, and he started paying extra special attention to what was going on in his home state. He's here with his wife, Allison. Allison and he helped lead Homes with Hope, an amazing organization that provides shelter and support for people in need. We have a lot of people in need right now. And I particularly enjoyed talking to Scott, not just about where we are here in Connecticut, what we see around the country, but he also is thinking about this summer and this fall and what we can learn from a guy who was, as you know, commissioner of the FDA under President Trump, an incredibly thoughtful and innovative commissioner. With that, let me introduce to you Scott Gottlieb.
Well, thank you for that, Governor. It's a real honor to be here today with everyone. I have a lot of ties to the state, as you mentioned. I went to college here at Wesleyan University in Middletown, Connecticut, practiced medicine for years at Stanford Hospital, now reside in Westport, Connecticut, and so I have deep ties to the state. And I want to thank you and your team for what you've done to get us through a very difficult moment in this state. We were hit very hard here in Connecticut, being in the tri-state area, and I think that this state has made it through some very difficult days under your leadership. We've been able to dramatically scale testing in the state. We supported the healthcare system. We're able to backstop doctors and make sure the healthcare system didn't get overwhelmed. And we're seeing transmission come down quite dramatically. And I think we're at a point in this state, as you rightly note, that we can start to contemplate a thoughtful stage reopening of economic activity, having been successful at flattening the curve and making sure the healthcare system didn't get overwhelmed and preserving life in the state. And now we're at that moment to try to start to restart activity in a thoughtful way. I would just start off by noting that, you know, I think we in this state had a very thoughtful approach in terms of what we did do when it came to population-based mitigation. And there were certain activities that continued in this state. I think it was very thoughtful and prudent, the approach that the state took in terms of allowing certain activities that were low risk, things done outside, for example, to continue during the mitigation phase. Going forward, I just want to touch on two points briefly, some principles for what I think should guide us, and I know this is guiding you and your team, and in what we can, you know, look towards as we head into the summer and the fall. It's going to be very important to lean on the case-based interventions as we go away from population-based mitigation, basically trying to suppress the infection by implementing measures on an entire population, which is what we were doing now. Now trying to target the virus itself and trying to support people who are infected, get them identified, get them tested. And we're going to be dramatically scaling testing resources in this state and try to track down people who may have been in contact with them and offer them testing and offer them interventions to try to enable them to self-isolate and make sure that that's non-punitive, that people are encouraged to get tested and self-identify with the virus and that being diagnosed with COVID doesn't become a punitive thing. We want to encourage testing in the community and get it out into the community. And particularly as you're doing, focus the testing on at-risk populations and at-risk sites. Not everyone is at equal risk of COVID. And we've seen some jobs, and we've seen some communities hit especially hard by this virus. And that's not unlike any infectious disease, where we see a disproportionate impact of infectious disease on certain communities and people who work in certain jobs. And this disease has been no different. And I think, to your credit and to the state's credit, you're thinking very, very heavily on focusing testing, both symptomatic and asymptomatic testing, on communities that have been hard hit and are more vulnerable to the virus. And the other thing I would do, and you and I talk about this, I'll just put in a plug for getting vaccinated for the flu going into this season, going into the fall. I think it's going to be very important to get flu vaccination rates up. And anything businesses and community leaders can do to try to move towards more universal vaccination for flu is going to be exceedingly important. First of all, it's going to improve our syndromic surveillance. It's going to improve our ability to detect COVID if we can reduce the incidence of flu. Second, it's going to reduce the burden on our healthcare system going into the fall. And, you know, people who got co-infected with COVID and flu, and there were quite a few in the beginning, especially when we looked at the data coming out of Asia, where flu was still epidemic at the time that COVID was circulating, had bad outcomes. And so we want to make sure that we can protect people at least from flu, even if we're not in a position to fully protect them going into the fall yet, with technology from COVID. And so what should we look towards? Well, as we reopen, we know there's going to be an uptick in cases. We expected that. We're going to see more hospitalizations. We're going to see cases grow. And that's why it's important to have a staged reopening, as this state is doing, and look at the data and lean heavily on those case-based interventions to try to reduce the number of cases that we see increase as a result of our increased social interactions. It's very important that as individuals, we continue to practice all those measures that we know reduce spread, wearing of masks in public where we can, good hygiene, remembering to socially distance where we can. Those kinds of individual practices done on a large scale have a dramatic impact on an epidemic spread. And so we should all continue to be prudent even as we reopen activity. Things done outdoors are generally less likely to transmit the infection than things done indoors. So we should look to move things outdoors where we can. And, you know, the state's thinking thoughtfully about that, about restaurants and other venues that we can move outside where there's a lower risk of transmission outdoors versus indoors. My hope is that as we move into the summer, there will be a seasonal effect here. I think there is a seasonal effect. We don't know how profound it's going to be, but respiratory illnesses and coronaviruses generally don't propagate as efficiently in the summer. Now, since we have no really cross immunity to this virus, it's very novel, we're still going to be susceptible to it in the summer, whereas normally we wouldn't be susceptible to a coronavirus in the summertime. But we should see the summer have some impact on viral transmission. And so hopefully as we reopen and we increase risk, the benefits of the seasonality of this virus will help offset some of that risk and maybe a lot of it. And we'll be able to have, hopefully, a quiescence in July and August and get back to more of our normal activities. And I'll just close by saying, you know, if that optimistic case comes true, and I hope it does, I hope we reopen with success. I think we will. And I hope that July and August, we can take a little bit of a breather and get back to more of our normal activities as viral transmission breaks off. We need to be vigilant for the fall because we will be facing renewed risk in the fall. By then, we're going to have a lot more in place in terms of therapeutics. We're going to have broad testing in place. We need to make sure that gets out into the community. We're going to have better practices in place, and we're going to be prepared. And so I'm optimistic for the future. I want to thank you, Governor, and your team for the leadership that you've shown through this crisis and what you've done for our state and my family personally in terms of making us more safe. And it's been a pleasure to work with you and your team. Thanks a lot.
Hey, Scott, that's great. And please stick around a little bit because we do have some questions from the press. And let me introduce to you Zeke Emanuel, who sadly does not have the same Connecticut roots. He's down in Philadelphia now with the University of Pennsylvania and a little bit of Chicago action there. And he has been an advisor to my wife's firm, which is in Connecticut. So there's a Connecticut link. But more importantly, I think you know Zeke from National Institutes for Health, Public Health, working in the Obama administration. H1N1, dealing with the contagious viruses, has some real experience there on the front line. Well-known bioethicist and oncologist, but one of the many things I love about Zeke is he makes it understandable in terms of what we're going through, what we can expect, and what it means to each and every one of us. Zeke, thank you so much for all the help you've been for our committee.
Thank you, Governor. And it's been a real pleasure to every week talk to the task force and try to offer advice and help. First of all, I do want to say you set up a very thoughtful process. I think people were considering lots of complicated issues and lots of complicated opinions in a situation of great uncertainty. And you did bring in some of the most wonderful people who were really able to meld and synthesize a lot of views. Let me say, because of, swift action and good public health measures, Connecticut is a really good example of a place where public health measures have worked. The case number are going down when the rest of the country is plateauing, and that is a good sign of how important the actions you took and the government, the state government took, are to putting you in a place where it's safer to reopen. I know that you and the task force have been considering very stringent criteria about reopening in terms of testing, in terms of case rates, and other factors. Connecticut is very advanced on those. I think, as Scott said, and let me endorse, you have really focused a lot of attention on getting the testing capacity up there. I'm affiliated with the Center for American Progress. We put in a very stringent criteria for reopening that deals with testing and deals with the number of new cases coming down and the percentage of positive cases. And Connecticut really has excelled in all of them and has passed our threshold for testing and for the number of cases coming down. I also think, as you and the task force have been thinking about it, a very detailed plan and a three-phase reopening project that does focus in, I think, to re-echo something that Scott Gottlieb said, protecting the vulnerable in nursing homes, prisons, and other circumstances, but also being aware that there are high-risk neighborhoods and working and focusing attention and resources on the high-risk neighborhoods and making sure you have the right infrastructure so that when you reopen, you can address any outbreaks that occur in these areas. I also want to laud the thinking about and the plan to do seroprevalence testing, so you know how many people in Connecticut, what proportion of the population actually has experienced COVID, and focusing in on other high-risk groups as you try to reopen colleges and universities, workers at the front line with frequent contacts. Again, very thoughtful approach to how to deploy the testing in its most optimal manner. And let me just echo two other things Scott has said. This emphasis on using face masks, on staying, having small gatherings, and having as much outdoors as possible are pretty evident in the way that the task force and your government have been thinking about reopening the process. And you've also developed a set of standards for when you might have to hold back and reverse course because their outbreak has gotten so severe. I would also finally say, emphasize two other points. In thinking about how to reopen and how to phase the reopening, I have been impressed by the thinking of both looking at the public health measures on one axis and looking at the economic impact on another axis. Both factors need to be taken into account, and you need to get to that sweet spot, places where the public health risks are low or you can lower them by measures like holding activities outside, and the economic impact is large so that when you open up, you have a lot of people going back to work and you have a large amount of economic activity that can resume. Using those different scales and melding them together to make informed judgments, I think, has been a hallmark of your government and the way the task force has approached it, and even the structure of the task force, having public health people alongside people who represent the economic community. Absolutely important. And then there are some areas where it's clear that the public health risks are very high
and the economic benefits are very low, and that you have been hesitant or the state should be hesitant about rushing into opening those. I personally, very nervous about casinos for exactly that reason. You can't go outside, as Dr. Gottlieb recommended. You have a high concentration of elderly people, and the economic benefits are not large to the state, either in terms of employment or in terms of the number of GDP. But the risks to people's health is very, very high. And I think thinking about how we trade these things off and doing it intelligently is going to be the key to having a success. Let me just end with one word, and I would echo what Scott Gottlieb has said. We are probably going to be lucky for the summer. Maybe the transmission rate and infectivity rate is down. We won't know. We'll find out. But it is the case that weather is warmer. People can do more activities outside, and we should take advantage of that because the documented number of transmission cases outdoors is extremely low. And that does mean that in the fall, come October, the whole situation is going to reverse, and we cannot let our guard down lest the reignite. So I think you have two advisors here who are from different parties, but both giving you very, very similar advice about proceed in the summer and how to make sure that you have the infrastructure in place in the fall should the coronavirus come back. And in conjunction with influenza. But you have done this as methodically, thoughtfully, and comprehensively and systematically as any group in the country, and I applaud those efforts.
This is Dr. Gottlieb answering a question here.
And these people can stay on important jobs and do so safely and with confidence that they're not going to get infected.
All right, one last question. You mentioned the therapies and the drugs. Are you seeing, you mentioned three or four different treatments. Is there one in particular that is most positive right now or has worked the best that might be easiest to replicate?
Yeah, well, so I think about what could be available for the fall. There's literally about 100 INDs, active investigational new drug applications on file with the FDA. They were about 73 weeks ago, and it's growing. I think about what can be available for the fall. We now have remdesivir available under an emergency use authorization. Supply of that will grow. That is a first-generation antiviral. It's active. It looks weakly active, but it's active against the virus. And I think if used appropriately, it could provide a therapeutic effect where it can reduce hospitalization and hopefully reduce death. I think the drug is going to be more beneficial if used early in the course of infection and most beneficial if used in people who probably are at higher risk of bad outcomes from coronavirus. But it's a first-generation antiviral, and it's available. And, you know, as Zeke will attest, if you think back to every virus that we've conquered with drugs, the first generation drugs weren't perfect. They were highly imperfect, but we got successively better drugs along the way, whether it was hepatitis C or HIV or many other viruses. The other drugs that could be available in time for the fall are those therapeutic antibodies that I talked about. There's four companies that are fairly far along. They'll be in the clinic this summer: Regeneron, local company, Amgen, Vir Biotechnology, and Lilly. All have therapeutic antibodies in development. And what these are basically are they're basically biotechnology copies of the antibodies that your body would produce if you were exposed to the virus, and they can be infused therapeutically. We developed these kinds of therapeutic antibodies successfully against Ebola, and it worked. We developed it successfully against MERS, which is a close cousin of this coronavirus, and it worked in large primates. We never put it into humans. We've done it against respiratory syncytial virus, but there's every reason to believe that we should be able to manufacture at scale therapeutic antibodies that can provide both treatment and early disease. They have to be used probably early to really have their full beneficial effect, as well as a prophylaxis. You can use them to prevent people from getting the infection. Now, you'd probably have to redose them on a monthly basis because these antibodies would only circulate for a period of time, but it could be used as a bridge to a vaccine. One or more of these I'm hopeful we'll be available in the fall. I hope one or more of these companies gets across the finish line. The biggest challenge is going to be supply. We're going to be supply constrained, so we're not going to have tens of millions of doses of these, but we may have millions of doses. So we'll have to figure out how we allocate that supply. But if you can couple remdesivir with one or more of these therapeutic antibodies with vaccines that you can use experimentally, but in the setting of outbreaks, with much broader screening that we're going to have in place, with the kinds of case-based interventions to track and trace that states like Connecticut are investing very heavily in, that's a much different toolbox. I mean, that is a toolbox that can help mitigate the risk of this heading into the fall. It's not going to prevent outbreaks from occurring. I think we're going to have outbreaks in the fall in different cities, in different states, and we're going to have to address that. But the hope is that we can prevent another national epidemic, and we can prevent those outbreaks from becoming very large with this kind of a toolbox.
Thank you, sir. Wow. Thank you very much.
Keep us moving, Max.
Channel 3 Eyewitness News.
Yes, question for our health policy experts. Can you quantify the difference in safety between reopening on May 20th as opposed to June 1st? Like, how much safer will the public actually be on the 1st?
So I don't think there's a major threshold that you're going to go pass that is different over 10 days, right? But what you are going to do is be able to put in place the infrastructure that is necessary and ensuring as much education of the public and as well as the business owners. Remember, you know, a lot of this is about the demand, right? And restaurant can open, but if people aren't willing to go and sit outside and get served, there's not a lot of economic activity going to happen. And you have to reassure the public that they're not going to get sick and contract COVID by engaging in commerce. So this is as much a demand problem as it is a supply and opening problem. And people also have to have the economic wherewithal to go out and shop. And so you have to understand that you have to spend some time convincing the public and convince them to wear face masks, to do the things that they can do, and to make sure that they understand that the businesses have good protocols in place to keep them safe, and the state has good protocols in place to keep them safe. And I think that's part of what you have to have going forward. And the more people engage in activities without a resurgence or with a resurgence that can be controlled and people see that it's growing safety, you're going to have more confidence in going out and engaging in social and economic activities.
Q&A going on involving that gentleman you just heard, Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel, University of Pennsylvania, and also previous to him, Dr. Scott Gottlieb, Connecticut guy, former commissioner of the FDA for a time under President Donald Trump. Back up north now to the state capitol and more from Governor Ned Lamont.
You've heard Josh describe this before. I think the number one metric we're looking at is hospitalizations. No more than 20% of the hospital beds are with the COVID patients. We know what type of latitude we have. We have probably 40% capacity in our hospitals now. But along the way, we're doing more and more testing, so we'll be able to detect flare-ups, as Scott said, contain those earlier. So I think we have more tools in our toolbox every month.
And then for Scott, regarding hydroxychloroquine, the president said recently that he's been taking it every day. Medical experts have said they do not recommend that. As the former commissioner of the US FDA, what's your take?
Well, look, I think early on, a lot of people were using hydroxychloroquine off-label, as you know, and people were taking it and a belief that it could provide some prophylactic value. I think a lot of that prescribing has declined as additional data has accrued that hasn't been promising. There were two studies published in the British Medical Journal about a week ago. There was a study in Columbia Presbyterian of about 1,700 patients. The Europeans have a big study underway. They did an interim look, so they allowed that trial to go forward, which is an indication that it wasn't causing harm, but we don't know if it was delivering benefit. They didn't allow the patients to cross over, so the signal evidently we can infer wasn't that strong. With respect to the president specifically, I would hope that the White House staff has the president in a strong enough protective bubble in terms of who's coming into contact with the president, how people are being tested before they come into contact with the president, that even if there was a drug that could provide some prophylactic value, and I'm not suggesting that hydroxychloroquine does, there is not firm evidence that it does at this time, but even if there was such a therapeutic, the president wouldn't necessarily be a candidate for it because he would be protected on the front end in terms of who's able to come into contact with him. And, you know, based on what we know and what we read in the press, they are implementing pretty aggressive screening in terms of who he's meeting with and who gets into contact and the distancing that he's engaging in. But that would be my hope, that it wouldn't necessarily take a therapeutic to provide protection to the president, that we would be implementing those measures in terms of how people are being screened before meeting with the president.
I have to say, it's a little ironic that the president is taking hydroxychloroquine as a prophylactic and refusing to use a face mask as a prophylactic.
News 12, Connecticut.
Hi, Governor. This question's for you. I want to ask you about enforcement. I mean, as we speak, Cromwell Town Council is holding an emergency meeting to discuss their options to essentially ignore your executive order and allow gyms and hair salons to be open. Essentially, the idea would be to just not enforce the order, not cite the businesses, you know, let them operate in plain sight. You know, if the towns don't cooperate, how do you get businesses to comply? How do you force them to follow the rules?
Well, I'd say to Cromwell and Enzo, we talked just the other day, let's keep our discipline a little bit longer. I don't want people peeling off, making exceptions. I don't care about these rules. Connecticut's been really good. You ask about enforcement. We didn't have to do a lot of enforcement. You know why? Because the people of Connecticut took our rules seriously, our safe workplace rules, our safe store rules. And I know it's getting summery out there and people are feeling a little frisky, but it's really important to do this. I'm not interested in going out there with state troopers enforcing. I really urge each and every one of you and the mayors to encourage each and every one of your businesses to do the right thing. And by the way, if they're not doing the right thing, customers, don't go.
So, Governor, though, I guess getting back to your point, if you're not going to send the state police out there to enforce the rules and the towns just refuse to comply, what's to stop these businesses from opening?
Well, look, obviously, I would talk to the mayor. I would say it's a municipal responsibility to enforce these rules. These rules are not just to keep the store owner safe, but the customer safe and your entire community safe. And I would try my moral persuasion, and if that didn't work and the municipal police were not interested in helping out, we'd get state authorities to give a friendly reminder that this is contrary to our laws.
So what state authorities are we talking about here, like DCP, the health department?
Yes, yes.